Alexander Hamilton would be pleased. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Good to be with you tonight. It's a beautiful night. We just, believe it or not, we've had a whole day of rain, which we desperately needed, and so it's
Amen.
A good weather day.
Amen. We have been very, very parched in this dear land of ours, but no fear, Charles, because you know that if something goes wrong in this country, we should just wait for government, because they can fix everything. And I'm sure that probably Nancy Pelosi and some others might have been doing a rain dance here earlier, and that's the reason why the Gulf Coast in Florida is getting absolutely deluged, and why we actually finally got some rain now, because it's all about government being able to take care of us.
Yes, that's it. I knew somebody was doing a rain dance somewhere, because it's dragging all the rain out of the Midwest and taking it to the Southeast.
Ladies and gentlemen, the reason why I'm a little sarcastic today is because you got to be careful what you read. And sometimes Chuck and I both, as we're doing the show prep for this program, read things that we just set back and we start getting a little snarky about. And I'll admit, this is a snarky evening, Charles. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking about an article by syndicated columnist E.J. Dion. Some of you may read him, as he's printed in the local newspapers every once in a while on the op-ed pages. This one actually is coming from the Sacramento Bee newspaper website, and it was on Monday of this week that E.J. Dion put pen to paper, or put fingers to keyboard, however way he's writing these days, and wrote an interesting little op-ed piece, or his thoughts and musings, on our dark god government. And actually, Mr. Dion is a devotee, a worshiper, an acolyte, if you will, of a certain view of government. That certain view, Chuck, we call
socialism.
Socialist, that's right. E.J. Dion is pretty much a socialist. We got this out of the Sacramento Bee. He usually writes his column for the Washington Post. Don't confuse that with the New York Post or the Washington Times, both of which are newspapers that are much more conservative than the Washington Post. Only found out to the left beyond is the New York Times. He brought this up with this article headline, "An Active Government is the Solution to the Troubled Economy." Chuck, like I said, you and I were laughing about this. We can get a little snarky. We can get a little sarcastic about this. But this is actually a really, really fine piece for certain things we like to do, isn't it?
Oh, that's right. Fallacy detection, baby.
Fallacy detection is one of them. The other is using the antithesis to underline why it's important to follow our constitutional form of government and
exactly.
biblical truths behind it.
Exactly.
And this is just chock full, gentlemen. If you get a chance, you go to either the Washington Post or to the Sacramento Bee, or I'm sure we will post this up on the Principled Policy website with our show link information so you can read it for yourself. But Dion is now standing out there giving an apologetic, being an evangelist for big government. Because he's upset, ladies and gentlemen, he's upset that his beloved Democratic Party is, shall we say, being shy and reserved, that they're not proudly, boldly proclaiming the truth, and I say that in quotes, the truth of big government. He says, why don't Democrats just say it? They really believe in active government and think it does good and valuable things. One of those valuable things is that government creates jobs, yes, really, and also the conditions under which more jobs can be created. Now, Charles, in that first opening paragraph, the one thing that really stands out to me is that Dion is trying to act like he's neutral. He talks about Democrats and they.
Yeah, it's the position of false neutrality.
It's a position of false neutrality.
Right. There is no such thing as neutrality. You're either for something or you're against it. You may take a position that you don't know everything there is to know about one position or another, and maybe say, okay, I don't know everything, and here's this case and here's that case. But the fact is, you're leaning one way or another. And Dion is being disingenuous here. Although he does let the cat out of the bag with this opening sentence. And I will say that I would agree with the end part of the sentence that you read.
Okay.
That government creates the conditions under which more jobs can be created. And you know the way they do that?
By getting it out of it and leaving it alone.
Bingo. By doing nothing. not necessarily by doing nothing, but by actually dismantling the onerous conditions under which businesses have to operate these days. If the federal government really, really wants to create jobs, then kill the minimum wage, kill the requirements for unemployment, kill the requirements for this tax, that tax, another tax, kill the requirement for businesses to have to pay half of Social Security and the FICA tax. That's what's killing job creation.
Well, no, Chuck, what's killing job creation, according to Dion, is the fact that progressives are not finding their spine and getting out there and trumpeting how wonderful government is, how it can solve everybody's problems, and in this election year debate, as he calls it, creating the antithesis and showing that all this free market stuff just leads to turmoil and chaos, and we need the steady hand of government, active and energetic government, as he coins a phrase from one of his favorite politicians, Alexander Hamilton, to come in and help provide that affirmation to the public that everything will be okay because Big Daddy government will be coming in and taking control and assuming their leadership role in our country's, as he calls, growth and financial success. Now, we've seen when government takes the reins through stimulus, through bailouts, through planning and controlling of the economy, through picking winners and losers, that, Chuck, what they really just pick are losers.
Yes, that's right.
They never pick winners. They always manage to somehow come up with the losers. I would say that outside of you and me, governments could be the ones never to go to Las Vegas.
They're the kind of people that you always look to be the guide for what to bet on because you find out what they're betting on and you bet against it.
And you go straight to the opposite end of it. That's right.
Yeah. It's interesting that he brings up Alexander Hamilton and Henry Clay because they were proponents of the system that he has been pushing here, and we'll be the first to admit that. And the fact is that both Alexander Hamilton and Henry Clay were wrong. And what they did was their great ideas bankrupted several states. Henry Clay was infamous for pushing canal projects. And for instance, states like Indiana and Illinois and a number of other Midwestern states were going to create this utopian paradise by creating these canals, which were going to drag all this commerce back and forth between all these cities that were going to be built as a result of the canals being built. And in fact, what happened was, for instance, Illinois defaulted on its obligations very early in the 1830s due to essentially going bankrupt over canal debts.
Well, absolutely. Well, but he waxes eloquent about Hamilton and Clay being farsighted American leaders that understood that action by the federal government was essential to ensuring the country's fight. And he goes into this whole list, developing the economy, promoting arts and sciences, building large projects. He talks about those canals and roads. And then he talks and says, under Abraham Lincoln, the institutions of higher learning that bound a growing nation together. And you know, Chuck, stop me if I'm wrong, but Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Dartmouth, Brown, most of the William and Mary, Penn, all of those colleges were around long before Abraham Lincoln was even a stripling nursing at his mother's breast.
Virtually the entire Ivy League, except for schools like Vanderbilt and Cornell, were around long before Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah,
and those ones came around, believe it or not, they were also privately funded. Vanderbilt by Cornelius Vanderbilt and Cornell by, I can't think of the guy's name, who funded Cornell, but that was private fortune money as well.
Or it was done by the churches, which was Harvard and Yale and Princeton. They were all church schools. But the point is, even if you wanted to give Abraham Lincoln credit, and I think you and I chatted about this offline, he's probably talking about land-grant universities, but land-grant schools didn't develop until the late 1860s, early 1870s, after Abraham Lincoln left the scene.
Well, for the most part, I did go to the first land-grant college. I went to Michigan State University, and that was 1855.
Okay, so we'll give you that one, but that was before Abraham Lincoln was more than a state senator in Illinois.
But the whole idea behind the land-grant college, Barry, if you look at it, the reason that the colleges were given a land-grant as part of their charter was so they could be self-supporting.
Exactly.
They didn't require gobboons of state money. They ran farms and ran businesses to keep money coming into the school so they would be self-supporting. That was the whole purpose behind the land grant. Now, of course, that's long gone.
No doubt.
Ohio State was a land grant institution, and guess what? How many gazillions of dollars a year does that absorb of tax money?
Oh, many, many.
Yes, but many more than on budget.
I think, though, Charles, in this article by Dion, he's got one paragraph in here that, ladies and gentlemen, I want to make sure that you listen to carefully, because it is the linchpin to everything. It's the hub upon which his entire wheel is turning. He says both Clay and Lincoln, and he should have said Hamilton as well, battled those who used states' rights slogans to crimp federal authority and who tried to use the Constitution to handcuff anyone who would use the federal government creatively.
You see, creatively. Don't you love that?
That's Dion's entire philosophy, his worldview, his raison d'etre, his reason for being, and that is that we can't have these Tea Party, states' rights, constitutionalists out there getting in the way of government being God. The Constitution shouldn't
now,
bind us to anything.
To bolster your point, read the next sentence. Both read the Constitution's Commerce Clause as Franklin Roosevelt and progressives who followed him did, as permitting federal action to serve the, quote, common good.
Yeah.
Where does that phrase common good come from?
I believe that's out of Marxism, isn't it?
It's Rousseau.
Rousseau, that's right, yes.
And Rousseau was one of the foundations for Marxism. Remember that Marx was a philosopher. He wasn't an economist.
That's right.
He was borrowing from Rousseau's common will, this common good idea. And all you have to do is restate it as Marx stated it. From each according to his means, to each according to his needs.
Right.
That is the common good. That is progressivism writ large, and that is Marxism.
And that is E.J. Dion's entire philosophy with this article, ladies and gentlemen. He's trying to set this whole idea that anybody who would be against all the things we've talked about, we're against the stimulus program, payouts, picking winners and losers, investing in certain segments of the market and using government's influence to boost certain segments like green energy, alternative energy. That's all good. All these people who would say, these conservatives who would say that it's wrong, well, you need to get out of the way, because you're handcuffing these people who are trying to be creative for us. And I think it's just interesting, Charles. He gets right down to it, and he says here that, so when conservatives say, as they regularly do, that government doesn't create jobs, the riposte should be quick and emphatic. Yes, it has, and yes, it does. And I think the counter riposte, Charles, should be, show us when, where, and how.
Show us the money.
Show us where government has created jobs, does create jobs, in any place other than the government sector. It's,
show us where government...
New commissions and bureaucracies and put people to work by sucking more tax dollars down, but let's see where you actually create a productive job that is not based upon taking all other people's money to pay for.
Show us where government has created a job that didn't disappear the minute the subsidy disappears.
The minute the subsidy disappears, the job's gone. That's exactly right.
We're going to have to wrap up here, but before we do, let's give a real quick discussion on this paragraph just before the paragraph you just read.
Sure.
And that is this thing about, it was thus salutary that Douglas Elmendorf, the widely respected director of the Congressional Budget Office, told a congressional hearing last week that 80% of economic experts surveyed by the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business agreed that the stimulus got the unemployment rate lower at the end of 2010 than it would have been otherwise. Only 4% disagreed.
And as you and I talked offline, that means 16% thought this question was so asinine and beneath them that they refused to respond. Because, ladies and gentlemen, the point is, we only have the data that's actually there. They can't go back and say, well, this did better than it
was. Yeah, you're right. That leaves 16% who thought the question was asinine. But let's get to the bottom line point here. If 80% of the economic experts had said there is a golden rainbow and at the end is a land all with unicorns and Skittles fall out of the sky, mm-hmm. Does that mean it's true?
No.
That's a meaningless statistic. So some economists thought for sure that some jobs got created by the stimulus. Based on what? The fact that a bunch of money flowed into the economy? That's an absurdity. You doled out some money, and then what happened to it? Remember that money generated by the private sector, there's an old saw that a dollar generated by the private sector goes around 7 times. A dollar generated by the government sector goes around twice. Therein lies the problem. We have zillions of dollars going around twice.
Mm-hmm.
And for every dollar that's taken out of the private sector to go into the public sector to go around twice, you have $1 less that can go around 7 times. And that's the bottom line.
You're losing $5 on the circuit, in other words.
Exactly.
For each dollar, you're losing $5.
Yeah. on each and every circuit. Well, that being said, we are out of time.
I figured as much.
All I can say is join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.